the piano player. Arlie says, "We're doing a show at the school in a week, Billy Joe. Come play with us." If I asked my father, he'd say yes. It's okay with him if I want to play. He didn't even know I was at the piano again till the other night. He's making some kind of effort to get on better with me now since I did him proud at the palace. But I say no. It's too soon after the contest. It still hurts too much. Arlie doesn't understand. "Just practice more," he says. "You'll get it back. You can travel with us again this summer if you'd like." I don't say it hurts like the parched earth with each note. I don't say one chord and my hands scream with pain for days. I don't show him the swelling or my tears. I tell him, "I'll try." At home, I sit at Ma's piano. I don't touch the keys. I don't know why. I play Stormy Weather in my mind, following the phrases in my imagination, saving strength, so that when I sit down at a piano that is not Ma's, when everyone crowds into the school for Arlie's show, no one can say that Billy Joe Kelby plays like a cripple. March 1935. No good. I did play like a cripple at Arlie's show, not that Arlie would ever say it. But my hands are no good anymore, my playing's no good. Arlie understands, I think. He won't ask again. March 1935. Snow. Had to check yesterday morning to make sure that was snow on the ground, not dust. But you can't make a dust ball pack together and slam against the side of the barn and echo across the fields. So I know it was snow. March 1935. Night school. My father thought maybe he ought to go to night school, so if the farm failed, there'd be prospects to fall back on. He's starting to sound like Ma. "The farm won't fail," I tell him, "long as we get some good rain." I'm starting to sound like him. "It's mostly ladies in those classes," he says. "They take bookkeeping and civics and something called business English." I can't imagine him taking any of those things. But maybe he doesn't care so much about the classes. Maybe he's thinking more about the company of ladies. I'll bet none of the ladies mind spending time with my father. He's still good-looking with his strong back and his blondy red hair and his high cheeks rugged with wind. I shouldn't mind either. It's dinner I don't have to come up with because the ladies bring chicken and biscuits for him. I'm glad to get out of cooking. Sometimes with my hands it's hard to keep the fire, wash the pans, hold the knife and spread a little butter. But I do mind his spending time with all those biddies. I turn my back on him as he goes and settle myself in the parlor and touch Ma's piano. My fingers leave sighs in the dust. March 1935. Dust pneumonia. 2 Fridays ago, Pete Guyman drove in with a truck full of produce. He joked with Calb Hardley, Mr. Hardley's son, while they unloaded eggs and cream down at the store. Pete Guyman teased Calb Hardley about the Wildcats losing to Hooker. Calb Hardley teased Pete Guyman about his wheezy truck sucking in dust. Last Friday, Pete Guyman took ill with dust pneumonia. Nobody knew how to keep that produce truck on the road. It sat filled with turkeys and heavy hens waiting for delivery. It sat out in front of Pete's drafty shack and sits there still. The cream curdling, the apples going soft. Because a couple of hours ago, Pete Guyman died. Mr. Hardley was already on the phone to a new produce supplier before evening. He had people in his store and no food to sell them. His boy, Calb, slammed the basketball against the side of the house until Calb's ma yelled for him to quit. And late that night, a truck rattled up to the store with colored springs, dozens of hens, filthy eggs, and a driver with no interest whatsoever in young Calb Hardley or his precious Wildcats. March 1935. Dust storm. I never would have gone to see the show if I'd known a storm like this would come. I didn't know when going in, but coming out a darker night I'd never seen. I bumped into a box beside the palace door and scraped my shins, then tripped on something in my path, I don't know what, and walked into a phone pole, bruised my cheek. The first car that I met was sideways in the road. Bowed down, my eyes near shut, trying to keep the dust out. I saw his headlights just before I reached them. The driver called me over and I felt my way, following his voice. He asked me how I kept the road. "I feel it with my feet," I shouted over the roaring wind. "I walk along the edge, one foot on the road, one on the shoulder." And desperate to get home, he straightened out his car and straddled tires on the road and off and slowly pulled away. I kept along. I know that there were others on the road. From time to time, I'd hear someone cry out. Their voices rose like ghosts on the howling wind. No one could see. I stopped at neighbors just to catch my breath and made my way from town out to our farm. Everyone said to stay, but I guessed my father would come out to find me if I didn't show and get himself lost in the raging dust and maybe die. And I didn't want that burden on my soul. Brown earth rained down from sky. I could not catch my breath the way the dust pressed on my chest and wouldn't stop. The dirt blew down so thick it scratched my eyes and stung my tender skin. It plugged my nose and filled inside my mouth. No matter how I pressed my lips together, the dust made muddy tracks across my tongue. But I kept on, spitting out mud, covering my mouth, clamping my nose, the dust stinging the raw and open stripes of scarring on my hands. And after some 3 hours, I made it home. Inside, I found my father's note that said he'd gone to find me, and if I should get home, to just stay put. I hollered out the front door and the back. He didn't hear. I didn't think he would. The wind took my voice and busted it into 1,000 pieces, so small the sound blew out over Ma and Franklin's grave, thinner than a sigh. I waited for my father through the night, coughing up dust, cleaning dust out of my ears, rinsing my mouth, blowing mud out of my nose. Joe DeLaFleur stopped by around 4 to tell me they found one boy tangled in a barbed wire fence, another smothered in a drift of dust. After Joe left, I thought of the famous Lindberghs and how their baby was killed and never came back to them. I wondered if my father would come back. He blew in around 6 a.m. It hurt the sight of him, brown with dirt, his eyes as red as raw meat, his feet bruised from walking in worn shoes, stepping where he couldn't see, on things that bit and cut into his flesh. I tried to scare up something we could eat, but couldn't keep the table clear of dust. Everything I set down for our breakfast was covered before we took a bite, and so we chewed the grit and swallowed, and I thought of the cattle dead from mud in their lungs, and I thought of the tractor buried up to the steering wheel, and Pete Guyman, and I couldn't even recognize the man sitting across from me, sagging in his chair, his red hair gray and stiff with dust, his face deep lines of dust, his teeth streaked brown with dust. I turned the plates and glasses upside down, crawled into bed, and slept. March 1935. Broken promise. It rained a little everywhere but here. March 1935. Motherless. If Ma could put her arm across my shoulder sometime, or stroke back my hair, or sing me to sleep, making the soft sounds, the reassuring noises, that no matter how brittle and sharp life seemed, no matter how brittle and sharp she seemed, she was still my Ma who loved me, then I think I wouldn't be so eager to go. March 1935. Following in his steps. Hayden Parley Nye's wife, Fonda, died today, 2 months after she lost her man. The cause of death was dust pneumonia, but I think she couldn't go on without Hayden. When Ma died, I didn't want to go on either. I don't know. I don't feel the same now, not exactly. Now that I see that one day comes after another, and you get through them one measure at a time. But I'd like to go. Not like Fonda Nye, I don't want to die. I just want to go. Away. Out of the dust. March 1935.